We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Away we go, episode 795 of the Al Galdi podcast. It is Monday, April 1st, 2024. It is April Fool's Day 2024, but it is no April Fool's Day joke that college basketball's Final Four in the 2024 NCAA tournament now is set. This Saturday evening at State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, one-seeded Purdue versus 11-seeded NC State at 6:09, followed by one-seeded UConn versus four-seeded Alabama. We, for just the sixth time in the history of the men's NCAA tournament, have an 11 seed in the Final Four. Two of the other times included Virginia schools, right? George Mason in 2006 and VCU in 2011. And as a Maryland fan, how sweet it was seeing 11-seeded NC State rip four-seeded Duke 76-64 at American Airlines Center in Dallas, Texas on Sunday evening. It's funny, the Maryland-Duke rivalry is basically dead with Maryland now in the Big Ten and Duke still in the ACC. But for someone like me who was at Maryland during the heyday of the Maryland-Duke rivalry, I still can't stand Duke, okay? And part of that, yes, is that Duke is one of the biggest heel brands in all of sports. But still, those unforgettable games between Maryland and Duke, especially in 2001 and 2002, are forever big deals in Maryland basketball. So with my team not being in the NCAA tournament for a second time in three seasons, I can at least take some joy in Duke not making yet another Final Four. Hello and welcome to this Monday installment of the Al Galdi podcast. There, over the last few days, was not much Commanders news. Something that we did get was the Commanders this past Friday morning announcing their workout slash practice schedule for the 2024 offseason. The first day of their offseason workout program is Tuesday, April 2nd. The first offseason practices are April 22nd through the 24th in a voluntary mini camp. Might we see perhaps the most popular free agent acquisition by the Commanders this offseason? Linebacker Bobby Wagner at that voluntary mini camp. Bobby Wagner, the final boss. That is the nickname that The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, now has for himself in WWE. That is a great nickname, the final boss. That to me is Bobby Wagner, the final boss. Next segment, we will go in depth on the final boss, Bobby Wagner, with Seattle Seahawks insider Michael Sean Dugar of The Athletic. Wagner has spent 11 of his 12 NFL seasons with the Seahawks, so we, from Michael Sean Dugar, will get very good insight on where Wagner is at in his career, his biggest strengths both on and off the field, and more. And yes, I will ask Mike about a certain Seahawks quarterback acquired via trade with the Commanders a few weeks ago, Sam Howell. What are the Seahawks thinking with Sam? Mike has some interesting things to say about that. Also on the show, comprehensive discussion and analysis of your Washington, D.C. area sports weekend, as this is the podcast that follows D.C. area sports so that you don't have to. I will talk Capitals as their push for the Stanley Cup playoffs continued with a 3-2 shootout loss to the Atlantic Division leading Boston Bruins at Capital One Arena on Saturday night. Yes, the Caps lost the game, but they remain in position to make the postseason. I will talk Nationals off them splitting the final two games of the team's regular season opening three-game series at the Cincinnati Reds. Saturday, a 7-6 win at the Reds in a game in which the Nats overcame a 6-4 ninth inning deficit. But Sunday afternoon, a 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds as closer Kyle Finnegan in the bottom of the ninth allowed three runs and got just two outs. But some really good stuff from the Nats in this series, including from infielder Trey Lipscomb in his first two Major League regular season games and from shortstop C.J. Abrams. I will talk Orioles off them splitting the final two games of the team's regular season opening three-game series against the Los Angeles Angels at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Saturday, a 13-4 win over the Angels as the Orioles' offense and starting pitching were outstanding for a second consecutive game. But then Sunday afternoon, a 4-1 loss to the Angels. And I will talk Wizards. Add two more losses to the quest for our tanking Wizards to get the number one overall pick in the 2024 NBA draft. Friday night, a 96-87 loss to the NBA worst Detroit Pistons at Capital One Arena. Sunday evening, a 119-107 loss to the Miami Heat at Capital One Arena. Before we get to some feedback, a new head men's basketball coach for James Madison, which on Friday afternoon announced the hiring of Preston Spradlin as head coach. He got a 6-year contract. He's just 37 years old, had been Morehead State's head coach officially since March 2017, although that was off him having been the school's interim head coach since December 2016. Spradlin led Morehead State to two of the last four NCAA tournaments, 2021 and 2024. Also led Morehead State to the Ohio Valley Conference regular season title each of the last two seasons. He is a John Calipari guy. Spradlin spent five seasons on the coaching staff of Kentucky head coach John Calipari, 2009-2010 through 2013-2014. You can hit me up on X at Al Galdi. You can email me the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. A lot of feedback on the Commanders' quarterback decision via their number two overall pick in the 2024 NFL draft, especially off some of our recent guests, Pro Football Focus senior data analyst and Commanders fan Nick Ackridge. He on last Monday's show, episode 790, gave us a great breakdown of Michigan quarterback J.J. McCarthy, including how he compares with North Carolina quarterback Drake May and LSU quarterback Jaden Daniels. Fantasy football writer Zachary Kruger of Roto World Football, he on this past Thursday's show, episode 793, gave us a terrific deep dive on the PFF metric pressure to sack rate, why it's so predictive for quarterbacks, and what it tells us about Jaden Daniels, Drake May, and J.J. McCarthy. And Commanders analyst Mark Bullock of Bullock's Film Room, which you can find at markbullock.substack.com. He's also a Commanders fan. He, on this past Friday show, episode 794, gave us analysis of Drake May versus Jaden Daniels versus J.J. McCarthy, including why Mark is warming up to May over Daniels. Email from Brent Anderson in Northeast D.C. writes, Brent, I love what the Commanders are doing this offseason. I haven't felt this positive about them really since I can remember. Adam Peters and Dan Quinn both seem to be the right choices. I am on board with every move that Peters and Quinn have made, with the exception of $6 million for Marcus Mariota. I'll get back to that. The big question, of course, is which quarterback the team should draft at number two. Recent NFL consensus seems to be leaning away from Drake May and toward Jaden Daniels. Both of these guys at interviews sound like exactly what you want to lead your team. I don't see a difference between the two and the type of guy you are getting. I trust that Peters and his team are going to pick the guy who can best convert third and 12, whichever guy that is. I found a pre-draft scouting report from Walter Football that I found interesting. It described the weaknesses of one Heisman Trophy winning quarterback heading into a draft. But it was a pre-draft scouting report for Marcus Mariota, you know, the busto second overall pick of the 2015 NFL draft, who we just bankrolled. I do trust that Peters and company know this, but if we are taking Daniels, it cannot be because of his elite mobility. If it's Daniels, it needs to be because he is better at converting third and 12 with his arm than May is. In my opinion, any mobility discussion needs to be supplemental to that. In all of NFL history, no quarterback whose best trait is his mobility has won a Super Bowl. Not Michael Vick, not Cam Newton, not Kyler Murray, not Lamar Jackson, not Josh Allen. Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen will rack up regular season wins and accolades, but those guys have not shown that they can get it done in the postseason. Thank you for the email, Brent. Interesting point on no quarterback whose best trait is mobility having ever won a Super Bowl. Certainly, mobile quarterbacks have won Super Bowls. Steve Young comes to mind. Patrick Mahomes comes to mind. But yeah, I wouldn't say that mobility was slash is either guy's best trait. John Elway won back-to-back Super Bowls, but they came over his final two NFL seasons when he was past his peak in terms of mobility. I guess the best argument that I could make against what Brent said would be Russell Wilson, right? He has won a Super Bowl, did so for the 2013 season. That would be the best argument against what Brent said. Although, was the best trait for peak Russell Wilson his mobility? I suppose that that's debatable. Just like, by the way, it's debatable that mobility is Jaden Daniels' best trait. It's one of his best traits, but is it his best trait? He has a lot of good traits, but there are things about him that concern me, and that is why I prefer Drake May for our Commanders. Email from Mike Bennett writes, Mike, I am firmly in the camp of Drake May over Jaden Daniels. I just don't think that Jaden can consistently make NFL-type throws on a weekly basis. He, this past season, was throwing to two wide-open receivers who will both be drafted in the top 20 in this upcoming draft. Well, that is great. The type of deep outs that he made a living on and helped him to win the Heisman Trophy can only happen a few times a game at best in the NFL. He needs to be able to complete throws in tight coverage over the middle on third downs. Last year, Terry McLaurin and Jahan Dotson weren't exactly great at creating separation. I think that fans fall in love with the big throws and big runs and don't understand what it takes to excel in the NFL at a high level. Drake can make the tight window throws and is no slouch running himself, not to mention the Drake Seinfeld drops that you will be able to use if the Cowanders draft May. Those drops will be great. Dare I say, scheduled fun. With that being said, I'll root just as hard for either guy. Jaden will look better in year one due to his running ability, but I think that in 2 to 3 years, Drake will be significantly better than Jaden. Thank you for the email, Mike. And thank you for the reference to the nickname, at least on this podcast, for the Commanders due to them having so many coaches and players from the Dallas Cowboys, the Cowanders. Shout out to Billy D in NC for that nickname. The receiver thing with Jaden Daniels is tricky. Yes, him this past season having been throwing to two stud receivers in Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas Jr. certainly played a role in Daniels' great 2023 season, what was by far his best season in college. But we had a similar situation with another LSU quarterback, Joe Burrow. Burrow, in his spectacular 2019 season, what to me is the greatest season that any collegiate quarterback has ever had, was throwing to two stud receivers in Justin Jefferson and Ja'Marr Chase. And there was a thought that those two guys perhaps made Burrow look better than he is. But as we have seen, Burrow in the NFL is a legit franchise quarterback. But like Mike, I am in the camp of preferring Drake May over Jaden Daniels. You gotta like the Drake, right?
I don't even like Drake.
You don't like the Drake?
I hate the Drake.
I love the Drake.
How could you not like the Drake?
Who's the Drake?
Who's the Drake?
The Drake is good. Oh.
Yeah, you gotta like the Drake. although I totally concede that there are many things to like about Jaden Daniels. Mike brought up the idea of Daniels perhaps hitting the ground running faster than Drake May might do. And that was brought up, among other things, by ESPN NFL analyst Dan Orlovsky in an appearance on the Pat McAfee Show this past Friday afternoon. Orlovsky has Jaden Daniels, not USC quarterback Caleb Williams, as the QB1 in the 2024 draft. This was Orlovsky, again, on the Pat McAfee Show this past Friday afternoon.
There hasn't even been a moment when I've second guessed it, to be honest with you. Like,
it's not a shot at Caleb. It's not a shot at Caleb.
No, it's not. I think Caleb is tremendously talented. I think the way I look at it is this, Pat. Like, okay, it depends organizationally. Are you of the philosophy, hey, at a minimum, when you're taking that guy early, we need a quarterback that, worst case scenario, we're going to win a lot of games with him. Okay, like, we're gonna win a lot of games with. Now, that's usually a rare situation because your roster is so bad, you need talent to overcome that, so you got to win games because of him. And I think, like, with the top teams, that's what I've said is a little bit unique in this draft, is like Chicago, I've said it, really good place. I think Washington is a solid place for a quarterback to go to. New England's the one that I sit there and go, they need a lot of help roster wise and then when Minnesota goes up, that's a great place to go. So I say, at a minimum, Jaden Daniels, at worst case scenario, is going to be a quarterback you win a lot of games with, just because he's very like routine based. He's repeatable. He's got great mechanics, very talented, and obviously unbelievably athletic. You're going to win a lot of games with a quarterback like that, as long as his character is what everyone says it is.
Yeah, Dan Orlovsky making a strong case for Jaden Daniels, and there is one, but I just have a hard time getting past two big concerns with Daniels. A, his reckless running style combined with his thin frame would seem to make him an injury waiting to happen, and B, his pressure to sack rate numbers are very disturbing, no matter how much you want to explain them away. I came across this stat the other day, career passing grade for Pro Football Focus in games against Power 5 conference teams. PFF grades are on a scale of 0 to 100. Drake May, 90.8. Jaden Daniels, 80.2. JJ McCarthy, 79.6. Another check in the column of Drake May. Well, there are many checks that you can give to the great law firm of Paulson and Nace. Paulson and Nace, it is a Washington, D.C.-based family law firm dedicated to promoting the rights of seriously injured persons and their families. Paulson and Nace handles medical malpractice, personal injury, birth injury, legal malpractice, and consumer protection cases, offering aggressive advocacy for victims in Washington, D.C. and West Virginia. If you have been harmed by the negligence of someone else, if someone who you care about has been harmed by the negligence of someone else, call Paulson and Nace at 202-902-7611. And when you call, make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Nace is widely respected throughout Washington, D.C. and West Virginia for the firm's accomplishments both in and out of courtrooms. In fact, Paulson and Nace was just named as part of U.S. News and World Report's Best Law Firms 2024 edition. And Chris Nace and Matt Nace specifically are dedicated and decorated trial attorneys. Chris Nace, last May, was named the 2023 Barry J. Nace Trial Lawyer of the Year, this by the D.C. Trial Lawyers Association. Chris, last July, was elected as the parliamentarian of the American Association for Justice. And both Chris and Matt Nace this past August were recognized by Best Lawyers in America for 2024. Why the accolades? Well, Paulson and Nace fights for you. Paulson and Nace does not accept low settlement offers that benefit the people who cause clients harm more than the offers benefit the clients. This is because Paulson and Nace is not afraid to take a case to trial. And that's because Paulson and Nace wins trial. Paulson and Nace has secured millions of dollars in verdict and settlement amounts for clients to better enable them to care for themselves and their families. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Ace. Call Paulson and Ace at 202-902-7611. That's 202-902-7611. Make sure that you tell Paulson and Ace that Al Galdi sent you. You can also visit PaulsonandAce.com. Just make sure that you tell Paulson and Ace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Ace, if you have a case, contact Paulson and Ace.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Hey, please consider following the podcast if you're not already doing that. Following the podcast is free. If you have an iPhone, you can follow the podcast simply by tapping the plus sign in the upper right corner on the page listing the recent episodes of this podcast. There, of course, are zero guarantees with how good the Commanders 2024 free agent class will prove to be, but the class has been very well received by both fans and media members, and perhaps the most well-received free agent acquisition by the Commanders this offseason is linebacker Bobby Wagner. The Commanders on March 15th officially announced the signing of Wagner as an unrestricted free agent. The contract reportedly is a one-year $6.5 million deal. He is going into his age 34 season, but he's coming off yet another productive season in a career that almost certainly will land him in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Wagner for the 2023 regular season, it was number one in the NFL with 183 tackles, registered an overall grade for Pro Football Focus of 82.4. PFF grades are on a scale of 0 to 100, and had a run defense grade for PFF of 91.5, ranking number two among all qualified NFL linebackers. Wagner, incredibly, has made the Associated Press All-Pro First Team or All-Pro Second Team for each of the last 10 regular seasons, 2014 through 2023. He was taken by the Seattle Seahawks in the second round of the 2012 NFL Draft out of Utah State, played for them for the 2012 through 2021 seasons, and also for the 2023 season. And so I am very pleased to welcome to the Al Galdi podcast Seahawks insider Michael Sean Dugar of The Athletic. He also is the co-host of the Seahawks Man to Man podcast. You can follow Michael Sean on X at Mike Dugar, and Dugar is spelled D-U-G-A-R. Mike, it's nice to talk to you. How are you?
Doing good, man. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. At some point, Bobby Wagner is going to fall off, but that sure has not happened yet. What are the Commanders getting in Wagner?
I was going to get a smart player with Bobby. That doesn't fade. You know, the guy's not be able to run as fast or jump as high, or, you know, be as durable as he get more tread on the tires, which is just normal part of the game. But Bobby's still going to be able to see the game at a high level. You know, I was watching some old, like, Legion of Boom era stuff, actually just the other night, and I just looking at the iterations of offense that Bobby has cycled through in his time since coming in 2012. You know, when he came in, it was a lot of 21 personnel, you know, pretty much every team rostered a fullback. And, you know, you had your best receiver. He was like your ex, you were outside the numbers guy. You know, think of like DeAndre Hopkins or like Randy Moss type guys, Larry Fitzgerald. And then he saw it evolve to what's kind of become more of like a spread-ish type of NFL-style offense, all these coordinators who want to sling the rock. And then I think we're slowly going to get back towards more teams like, hey, you want to play too high, we're going to run this rock. And Bobby's seen that too. So I think that the smarts are one thing, the consistency, the leadership. Like Bobby's he's always a good leader, knows what to say, when to say it. So I think those things are all going to help, particularly if Dan Quinn and even Ken Norton Jr. are trying to like build a culture over there. Bobby's a good like person to have when you're trying to lay a foundation, and young guys or even guys who are maybe veterans, or even someone like Terry McLaurin, who's a veteran, does all things the right way, is a leader, just to see what it looks like from a Hall of Famer guy's, you know, perspective. What does he do? How does he train? What time does he get in the facility? How does he watch film? How does he take care of his body? You know, I think it's going to be good for everybody in that regard, for sure.
Did you last season see any signs of decline in Bobby Wagner, or not really?
Oh, I mean, he just can't physically do what he used to do in, you know, 2012, 13, 14. I mean, when he came in the league, and the reason that he started, you know, right away as a rookie is because he can fly at about 243 pounds. Right? And if you look at some of these linebackers now and look at the weights of some of these kids come out of the draft, you ain't gonna find a kid weighing 240. If you do, he's a rushing passer these days. So, like, that was Bobby's special, like, superpower at the moment. He's not doing that now. He knows that. I mean, if you ask Bobby to turn and run with, you know, some over route 40 yards down the field, I mean, that's your fault as a coordinator, right? Like, KYP, know your personnel. But he can still cover. He still recognizes what routes try to attack him. You just got to put him in positions to succeed. I think what the Rams did in 2022 was really smart. They were like, hey, on third downs, which is obviously the passing down, we're not going to try to have you manning up tight ends. We're not going to make it so you're like on the weak side and have to cover some shifty slot dude. No, no, no. We're going to have you blitzing. I think that year he had 6 sacks, which might have been a career high. And if you got to be in coverage, you're going to have you cover these backs on these angle routes, maybe some, you know, dump offs to the flat, things like that, that keeps you coming downhill. Right? Seattle didn't do that as much last year. And I think that's why some fans in Seattle, like, it's time to move on from him. But I think there's a way to kind of work around his limitations because they exist, right? Like you said, age 34 season, there's not many people in the world moving the same way they were at 34, they were, you know, 22. You know, that's whether you play football or wiffle ball. It doesn't really matter. So I think it's going to be important for Dan and Ken and all the defensive coaches to work around what he can and cannot do. Because, yeah, if you're asking him to cover downfield 30 yards, you're stupid. Don't do that. but the run game, recognizing stuff, knowing his fits, being able to point his teammates in the right direction, set the front, all that stuff will be. None of that stuff has changed. You can see that in the tackle numbers and the run stuff and all that.
You mentioned Bobby Wagner spending the 2022 season with the Los Angeles Rams. They, on March 31st, 2022, announced having agreed with him as an unrestricted free agent on a 5-year contract, but they, on March 1st, 2023, announced that they and Wagner had mutually agreed to part ways, and he, later in March 2023, signed back with the Seahawks. What was the deal with all of that?
Yeah, that was a case of, I mean, and fans in Washington know this, that was a case of decision makers not being on the same page about a player. It's very rare that it's a star player in Seattle. I know you guys in Washington have seen that a few times, but it's a very clear case of Pete Carroll thinking, hey, let's keep Bobby. And John Snyder saying, no. And I use that as an example of, like, Pete had veto power and final say over personnel. But he deferred to his general manager, right? He's the general manager at the end of the day. It's his job to control the personnel. So he told Pete, nah, man, we got to move on from this guy. So they moved on. And then Cody Barton wasn't as good as they thought. So he walked and went to Washington. And then Jordan Brooks blew his ACL on New Year's Day following season. So they were like, hey, let's bring Bobby back. The linebacker market's not great. how about it? And John and Pete said, okay, we can agree this time. And now with Pete gone, I just think there was no chance that Bobby was coming back this year. Maybe there was a chance behind the scenes and I couldn't sense it, but I mean, if John was like, let's move on from this guy after 2021, in which Bobby was a Pro Bowler, was on pace to lead the league in tackles, was playing just fine on one of the best run defenses in the league, I can't imagine how 2 years later he'd want to keep paying him anything more than the veteran minimum and keep starting him. So not to say that John hates Bobby, but you know what I mean? Like, if he wanted to move on 2 years earlier, there's no reason for him to want to keep paying him 2 years later.
That's a really good point. The leadership of Bobby Wagner comes up a lot. Leadership is hard to quantify, but we know that it exists. What examples of leadership from Wagner can you give us?
Yeah, it's different for different guys. So, for instance, for like DK, Bobby was really big for DK in a few ways. One of them was just being consistent and work ethic. You know, I think those two would work out on Tuesdays together. There's a facility up here on the east side of Seattle that they would train at the offseason together. Bobby's a good, like, businessman, so he would help DK with that. Like, you see DK movie commercials, celebrity all-star games, brand deals. Like, he just helped DK with the business side of things. And DK's got a business manager, too, but you know what I mean. It's different when it comes from a player. And then the other part that he helped DK with, I think, was handling the limelight. You know, DK is a fiery cat. Cameras are always on him, whether he's on the field or not, you know, whether he's having a sideline outburst or getting a personal foul for pushing a guy or fighting a guy. That's a lot of, like, pressure to deal with when you're famous, right? After he chased down Buda Baker, his star power just shot up. Right? It was crazy. But Bobby's seen how that looks, right? Real tight with Richard Sherman. You know, he was real tight with Legion of Boom, so he knows what it looks like when everyone's eyes are on you as a star player and you got to conduct yourself accordingly. And that was helpful for DK to get that, like, wisdom from a guy who's seen it. Now, the eyes weren't on Bobby. He's not a firecracker. But when you hang out with Sherm, Sherm at his peak was the firecracker of all firecrackers. Right? So he was able to mentor him in that way. And then for some other guys more broadly, it was really just about behavior. It was like, hey, Bobby's here at 5:59 every day, right? Like, he's watching film this way every day. And Bobby has a regimen. He, you know, acupuncture, yoga, whatever, you know, like, however he does his stuff, it's consistent every day, every week. Take care of his body, preparation, all that stuff. And it's not something that he has to go around the building and be like, hey, I do it this way, you should too. But when you see the results and you see the consistency, that's when other guys are like, maybe I should get here at 5:58. You know, maybe I should, you know, pay a little bit for the acupuncture or the massages or go swimming in the off day or whatever it is, or meditate, however you need to conduct yourself. You know, Bobby's kind of an example of like, hey, there's a guy who's about to wear a gold jacket in the building. Here's how he gets down. I should get down like that if I want to wear a gold jacket. And the interesting thing I've seen over the last few years is how much that's impacted offensive guys. DK is an example, but like Ken Walker is another guy who's like, yo, what Bobby's doing is the way to get down. You know, like, he's a good example. So I think that's one of the ways his leadership shows up. Like, maybe he might give a speech here or air, a pep talk or something like that, or some on-field wisdom, sideline wisdom. But I think really it's Saturday to Monday, or Monday to Saturday, I guess, that really Bobby stuff shows up, because so much of what happens on Sunday is how you prepare physically and mentally, and Bobby's been around the game so long, he just kind of knows how to get that done.
We're talking Bobby Wagner and more with Seahawks insider Michael Sean Dugar of The Athletic. Bobby Wagner has come to the Commanders with multiple connections to the team. Commanders head coach Dan Quinn coached Wagner during Quinn's time as the Seahawks defensive coordinator from January 2013 to February 2015. And Commanders linebackers coach Ken Norton Jr. coached Wagner during Norton's time as the Seahawks linebackers coach from January 2010 to February 2015. And during Norton's time as the Seahawks defensive coordinator from January 2018 to January 2022. You've covered the Seahawks since 2017, so you were there for all of Norton's tenure as Seahawks defensive coordinator. What are your thoughts on Norton?
Yeah, I think he's a pretty decent coordinator. I know I should say this. His strategy, like, I understand it. You know what I mean? Like, the numbers have not been great. So you hear me say decent coordinator, and you look up, like, his ranks when he's been DC, and you're like, Mike, you're bugging. I feel you. His defenses don't usually reverse a lot of turnovers. That's an issue. But, like, schematically, I see it. Like, I see the vision. Like, even this last couple of years when Seattle struggled with some stuff after they fired him, they were slowly creeping back towards some things that Ken was trying, you know, whether it was sub-package stuff or some stuff with their fronts. You know, so I think he had the right ideas a lot of the time. For whatever reason, just couldn't get the guys to consistently execute it. I also think he didn't have a lot of talent when he took over as defensive coordinator in Seattle. I can't speak to the Raiders stuff. The Raiders have just been bad for so long. Who knows what the real issue is down there. But in Seattle, I think he got dealt a bad hand a little bit. And ultimately, I think he was kind of the scapegoat for bigger issues. And I mean, Pete getting fired just a couple years later and the defense getting worse after Ken left probably speaks to what I'm saying, right? Like, it wasn't his fault the defense was bad on third down or whatever. You know, even in his last year, they had great run defense. Pass defense was shaky, for sure. But they had one of the best run defenses in the league. He leaves, thing falls apart, right? And they never fix it, despite getting more talented players, at least on paper. So, you know, I think schematically he's going to have the right ideas. Really great linebackers coach. And I think it just really matters. You know, the more I talk to players, when your position coach is a guy who played, particularly a guy who played at a high level in the NFL, it just resonates so much, man. I mean, he don't have to, like, flash his Super Bowl rings or anything or walk around being like, back in my day. But, you know, he just knows the game. You know, he's been around great players at all positions. And when he's coming in there and reaching you as a player from a player level, like player coach level, saying, hey, I know how you feel. I know how your body feels after this. I know what you're dealing with that. I know how you're adjusting to the speed of the game when you have to make the calls or this and this, all these other things. That I think that helps a lot, particularly with his – with the linebacker. So I think it could work out. Not gonna lie, I don't know the whole Commanders roster defensively. I don't know if it's good or bad or not. But like, I think he'll have the right ideas. He'll have a decent plan, you know, which is like, what, 60% of the job for a coordinator? Then I guess the rest of it is just in-game stuff and having the guys be consistent and get the messaging and go out there and produce.
So the Commanders' busy 2024 offseason has included a trade. They, on March 14th, announced having traded quarterback Sam Howell to the Seahawks. Now, I personally wanted the Commanders to keep Sam because I still see him as having upside, and until they have quarterback truly figured out, they should be retaining and developing as many young quarterbacks as reasonably possible. But what is done is done. The Seahawks president of football operations and general manager is John Schneider, who actually worked for the Redskins years ago. He was the Skins' vice president of player personnel for the 2001 season. But what are the Seahawks thinking with Sam Howell?
Oh, no, I know what they're thinking. They're thinking, man, this guy's got a hose. He's tough, and he can sling the pill. You know, I know that's what John Snyder's thinking. And it's really interesting the way John views quarterbacks, because Pete Carroll was really anti-turnover guy. Like, his thing was protect the football. It's all about the ball. And he wanted his quarterbacks to, like, just at, like, a fundamental level to throw a catchable pass. I think that's something he picked up from Bill Walsh. John Snyder doesn't, like, disagree, right? He doesn't want turnovers. But, boy, he don't care if you have them. Because, I mean, Geno Smith, his profile was kind of similar to Sam Howell's the first time being a starter. I mean, Geno, I think he led the league in interceptions. He was real close to it one of those first 2 years in New York. And he put up some numbers, but he was turning the ball over. As you guys know, Sam was the king of negative plays last year. He led the league in interceptions and had a bazillion sacks, right? Like, that's a lot of negative stuff happening when you drop back. And Seattle traded for Drew Lock, right, who I think led the league in interceptions in 2020, which was his first year as a starter. So for some reason, when John sees you can sling that thing, he don't care if it goes to the team sometimes. It's almost like he's looking at a guy and be like, I can fix him. Give him to me. And clearly that worked with Geno. I wouldn't call it worked with Drew, but he kind of got better at it. But I don't know how much of that was working with Pete and his staff versus just John getting his hands on him, you know, John the GM. So I see the vision there. It's the same thing, same type of profile. Big arm guy, maybe the situation he got drafted to wasn't great, can sling it around, a little reckless with it, but if he gets in the right situation with maybe a better supporting cast, he can cut down on those turnovers and maximize more of the good. Like, I see the vision. Do I agree with the vision? No. But because I actually did watch a little bit of the Commanders last year, and I was like, ooh, man. This guy, I don't know what Eric Bieniemy's thinking with all these dropbacks. But for what it's worth, I felt the same way about Geno. When they got him, I was like, I don't know, man. Like, he really gives the ball to the other team quite a bit. I'm not a fan of that. I'm on the Pete side of things with that. So we'll see. I think I bring all that up to say, with Geno and Drew, there was like a common denominator there of like, or the reclamation projects with guys who you know, had some potential because of their arm talent, but had a huge problem with turnovers that ultimately cost them their jobs. So there's a trend. John has a type. We'll see if it works out.
With Geno Smith, the Seahawks in March 2023 re-signed him to a three-year contract. How committed are they to Geno as their starting quarterback?
Yeah, not that much. Not that much. It's more. It's almost a difference between like leasing a car and like actually buying it. You know, it's like you lease the car, you got the car for a few years, right? You're like, I'm gonna drive this thing for 36 months or whatever the lease agreement is. But lease agreement kind of understands like I'm not gonna buy this thing forever. When these months are up, I'm gonna find a better car if I can, or at least another one of these. That's kind of how I view the Seahawks' commitment to Geno. It's a lease. They ain't really commit. You know, they 3 years, like you said, and when those years are up, all right, we might. We'll see. We'll see how it drove, how the brakes worked, how it handled itself in the winter, how my tires are. You know what I mean? How many often do I need to get an oil change? Stuff? Did I have a sunroof? You know, so I think that's kind of the view of it. Geno's a good player. He's a really good player, but the commitment is just not the same. You know, you can see it from the moment he signed the contract and the structure came out. I think only the first year really had that guaranteed money. They built in and out, like, right away after the first year. Compare that to, like, Daniel Jones' contract. They both signed it around the same time. The Giants guaranteed the first 2 years of Daniel Jones' deal. And he basically was like Geno. He wasn't very good for the first part of his contract. Balled out 1 year and then got paid. Meanwhile, the Giants were far more committed to Daniel, who wasn't as good, versus how the Seahawks were committed to Geno. So it's definitely a one-foot-in, one-foot-out type of commitment. You know, it's a, hey, I like you right now. If you keep playing at that level you played in 2022, but the minute you don't, we have outs in this contract, and we can go find someone else. So Geno is constantly on just a really expensive prove-it deal, for lack of a better term. Not to say that's right or wrong, but that's definitely what it is in Seattle.
Final question, the Seahawks' new head coach, Mike McDonald. The Commanders reportedly were in on him, and depending on what you believe, may have even offered him their head coaching job before hiring Dan Quinn. McDonald spent the last two seasons as the Baltimore Ravens defensive coordinator. What are your initial impressions of McDonald?
I didn't get a chance to meet him at his introductory press conference. I was on parental leave, but I was hoping to meet him at the combine, and he decided to just not show. So I think we're just avoiding each other. So our relationship is not starting off great. One thing that's kind of been interesting is his staff choices. Well, staff and free agent choices. Usually, as we're seeing like an example in Washington, when a guy gets hired, he goes through his call log and says, who do I know? Who do I trust? I want them to come play for me or come work with me. You know, that's usually how it goes. Dan Quinn went and called everybody he knew and said, hey, come on, pull up to D.C., let's go. McDonald did none of that. He hasn't brought one Ravens player, Josh Bynes, to like be his assistant linebackers coach, but I mean, Josh just retired. He's never been a coach before. So outside of him, Mike McDonald didn't take any Ravens coaches with him. He didn't sign any Ravens players that were, you know, free agents, no Geno Stone, Clowney, Patrick Queen, a couple others, you know, didn't bring any of those guys. I'd say that's wrong. Basically, what Seattle has done is, when people were taking Pete Carroll's guys, his defensive coaches from the Legion of Boom years, usually they were taking a couple people. They would take like Dan Quinn and someone else. They would take Gus Bradley and at least one other guy. You know, even you look at what happened with Dave Canales on the offensive side. The Bucs took him and took an assistant receivers coach, Isaac, who's now in Carolina with him, to only take the one guy, right? To watch the Ravens last year and be like, I just only need Mike McDonald, and I can do it. I'd say that's right or wrong, but that's interesting because now he has a staff full of unproven guys who haven't done the job that they're being asked to do now at the NFL level, guys who don't even really know each other that well. I think John Snyder joked on the radio a couple weeks ago that they're wearing name tags in the facility. You know, I don't know if they actually are, but it would make sense. Half these dudes never met, right? So it's a huge leap of faith there. Mike McDonald is kind of spun it as, I'm not hiring people I know necessarily. I'm hiring people I feel like are going to be good at the job, which is like, cool. Meritocracy is great. But if this thing doesn't work, this will be so easy to point back to and be like, dude, you hired a bunch of dudes who hadn't done these jobs before and didn't know each other. Of course it failed. But if it works, it's like, oh my goodness. Look at this like little melting pot in Seattle Mike McDonald created. You know, maybe this is the new wave in the NFL. Nepotism is bad. You know how that goes. So, I don't know which way it'll go, but I feel like it's going to end up on one end of the extreme or the other. You know what I mean? This flops, and we'll be able to look back on this and be like, Mike, what were you thinking? Or he's a genius, and it's like, wow, Mike McDonald is good. He's cracked the code of like being a head coach in the NFL.
The result drives the narrative, as you well know.
Yep.
Terrific stuff. Seahawks insider Michael Sean Dugar of The Athletic. Mike, thank you, and all the best.
All right, thanks for having me, man.
All right. Well, we did just have Easter on Sunday, and yes, it is spring, but are you prepared for next winter? Heck, lately it at times has felt like winter, but Nova Fireplace and Stove is outstanding. It offers fireplace safety inspections, fireplace tune-ups, and gas fireplace repairs. And if yours is a fireplace that burns wood, Nova Fireplace and Stove offers chimney safety inspections and chimney cleanings. And if you have a masonry fireplace, listen up. Nova Fireplace and Stove right now is offering the following deal to listeners of the Al Galdi podcast: an in-stock wood insert at an extremely discounted price, just $6,000 plus tax. The usual price is $9,000 plus tax, so this is a 33% discount, and the $6,000 plus tax includes installation, permit, and county/city inspection, and you can get a government-funded tax credit as well, up to $2,000, dropping the price to just $4,000, all things considered. Nova Fireplace and Stove. It is awesome. It is family owned. It is a 5-star dealer. Visit NovaFireplaceAndStove.com to check out customer reviews, and call Nova Fireplace and Stove 571-513-3803. Talk to Stuart Moore. He is the general manager. He's a big Commanders fan, and he's a loyal listener of this podcast. And make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. Nova Fireplace and Stove, 571-513-3803. And make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. Nova Fireplace and Stove also installs generators, water heaters, security lights, and custom outdoor kitchens. There is so much that Nova Fireplace and Stove can do for you. Contact Nova Fireplace and Stove and get the customer service that you deserve. 571-513-3803. And make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. That's Nova Fireplace and Stove, 571-513-3803. And make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. Well, if you know your Capitals history, you know that the Caps don't exactly have the greatest history on Easter weekends. April 18th, 1987, the unforgettable 3-2 quadruple overtime loss to the New York Islanders at Capitals Center in Landover, Maryland, in Game 7 of a first-round series in the Stanley Cup playoffs. The game is known as the Easter Epic, because the game began on a Saturday night but ended in the early morning hours of Easter Sunday in 1987. The game remains the longest Game 7 in NHL history, and the game concluded the Caps losing a series in which they held a 3-1 series lead. The Caps lost each of the final three games. April 20th, 2003, what was Easter Sunday 2003, a 2-1 triple overtime loss to the Tampa Bay Lightning at what was then known as MCI Center, and that was Capital One Arena in Washington, D.C. The loss happened in Game 6 of a first-round series in the Stanley Cup playoffs, as the Caps in the series blew a 2-0 series lead by losing each of the final four games. Well, Easter weekend 2024 goes down as an at least decent weekend for the Caps. They, over the weekend, had just one game, a 3-2 shootout loss to the Atlantic Division leading Boston Bruins at Capital One Arena on Saturday night. So, yes, a loss, but the Caps got a point, and they gained ground in their playoff race, because also on Saturday was the Philadelphia Flyers losing at home to the Central Division worst Chicago Blackhawks 5-1 on Saturday night, and was the Detroit Red Wings losing at the Florida Panthers 3-2 in a shootout on Saturday. So the Caps for this NHL regular season now are 36-27-10 and now have 82 points, tied with the Flyers for third in the Metro Metropolitan Division, but the Caps have played two fewer games in this regular season than the Flyers have. So the Caps have the tiebreaker. The top three teams in each division make the Stanley Cup playoffs, and the Caps are 2 points ahead of the Red Wings, who are 2 points behind the Flyers for the Eastern Conference's second and final wild card spot. The game-winning goal in this 3-2 Cap shootout loss to the Bruins on Saturday night was scored by a former Caps defenseman, Kevin Shattenkirk, who actually had been a healthy scratch for the Bruins in five of their last seven games. Charlie Lindgren on Saturday night was the Caps starting goaltender for the 26th time in 34 games, and he was good. He stopped 27 of the 29 shots on goal that he faced, including all 12 of the shots on goal that he faced over the third period and overtime. The Caps lost the puck possession battle, but did a good job of limiting the high danger shot. The Caps had just 20 shots on goal to the Bruins' 29, and per natural stat trick had just 42 5-on-5 shot attempts to the Bruins' 53, but the Caps' per natural stat trick had 8 5-on-5 high danger shot attempts to the Bruins' 6. Lindgren, per natural stat trick, faced just 4 high danger shots on goal the entire game. He stopped 3 of them. The Caps went 2-2 on the penalty kill, and the Caps went 1-4 on the power play. And the one was quite the one. Defenseman John Carlson scored a power play goal 14:03 into the second period to tie the game at 2, and this was a milestone goal for Carlson on a milestone night for Carlson. The goal was Carlson's 149th NHL career regular season goal, tying him with Kevin Hatcher for the most regular season goals by a defenseman in Caps history. And the goal came in Carlson's 1,000th NHL regular season game as he became the 392nd skater in NHL history and the 128th defenseman in NHL history to play in at least 1,000 NHL regular season games. Carlson on Saturday night had a team high 30 minutes, 16 seconds of ice time as the Caps were down multiple defensemen. Rasmus Sandin did not play due to a lower body injury, and Ethan Bear is in the player assistance program of the NHL and the NHL Players Association. So John Carlson, in his age 34 season, played for 30 minutes, 16 seconds on Saturday night. He, for this regular season, is number one among all Caps skaters in average time on ice per game. Here was Caps head coach Spencer Carberry during his post-game press conference on Saturday night on John Carlson.
I felt like today you could tell he was pressing a little bit. Like, he had some touches where he was even very rarely do you get John Carlson sort of rattled, but there was a couple instances tonight where I glanced down on him and I knew, just took a look at him, and he's kind of like showing some frustration of like, what is that? With some pucks that came to him, and all of a sudden they're coming back. They actually got a couple chances off a few of them, but you could tell he really wanted to have a positive impact, and so he does exactly that. He delivers a huge goal to get that game at 2 and essentially gives us the point tonight.
Yeah, now, I mentioned the Caps on Saturday night going 1-4 on the power play. The Caps in overtime failed to score on a 4-minute 4-on-3 power play. That was disappointing. Also on Saturday night, top line left wing Alex Ovechkin, he had no points, but also had a game-high 14 total shot attempts, though 10 of his shot attempts were blocked. The Bruins had 29 blocked shots to the Caps 19. Additionally, Ovechkin failed in his attempt in the shootout, falling to 0-for-7 in shootouts in this regular season. I know that he is the great eight, and we love him, but Ovi has not been good in shootouts this season, and as the Caps are in this playoff race, I don't think that it's crazy to say that Spencer Carberry should not have Ovi taking part in shootouts the rest of this regular season. One other item from Saturday night, winger Sonny Milano was back. He returned from a 2-game absence caused by an upper body injury that he suffered in the Caps 3-0 win over the Winnipeg Jets at Capital One Arena. Now, two Sunday afternoons ago, March 24th, Milano on Saturday night served as the Caps' third-line right wing. Next up for the Caps at the Buffalo Sabres, Tuesday night at 7 in the final game of winger Tom Wilson's 6-game suspension. Well, the Nationals began their 2024 regular season with an ugly 8-2 loss at the Cincinnati Reds this past Thursday in Game 1 of a three-game series. But the Nats, over the weekend in the final two games of that series, in many ways outplayed the Reds. However, the Nats only won one of those final two games of the series. Saturday, a 7-6 win at the Reds in a terrific win for the Nats, a game in which the Nats overcame a 6-4 ninth inning deficit, but Sunday afternoon, a 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds as the Jekyll and Hyde nature of Nats closer Kyle Finnegan struck again. Kyle Finnegan is a guy who's good is quite good, but his bad is quite bad. Now, in fairness to Finnegan, this is true of many relievers. Heck, that's why these guys are relievers and not starting pitchers. But with Finnegan, the Jekyll and Hyde nature seems even more pronounced. And that Jekyll and Hyde nature was on full display on Sunday afternoon. He came into the game to begin the bottom of the ninth with the Nats holding a 5-3 lead. He, in that bottom of the ninth, allowed three runs and got just two outs. Now, Finnegan retired the first two batters he faced. It looked like the Nats were well on their way to winning the game and winning the series. But then came a nightmare of a sequence. Finnegan gave up a two-out full-count double by Jonathan India to left field to conclude a 10-pitch plate appearance. Finnegan then gave up a game-tying two-out first pitch, a two-run homer by Will Benson to left center field to tie the game at 5. The homer went a projected 411 feet per Statcast. And Finnegan then gave up a walk-off, tie-breaking, two-out solo homer by Christian Encarnacion Strand to left field for a 6-5 Nats loss. Just like that, the game was over and the Nats had lost. The Nats were one strike away from winning the game and winning the series, but then everything came apart over a stretch of just four pitches. Nats manager Davey Martinez, during his post-game session with reporters on Sunday afternoon, on Kyle Finnegan.
That's tough. I mean, 3-2, two outs, double, homer. I mean, that's how the game ended. So it's tough. But you know what? The last two games, you know, I'm pleased about how we played the game. You know, we played hard. We played tough. It's just unfortunate when you get a chance to go into ninth inning with your closer. You know, good things happen. So tonight it didn't happen. So we get to go home and have a home opener tomorrow and go 1-0 tomorrow.
What adjustment, if any, would you have liked to see Finnegan make there?
Just location right there. Just two balls up in the zone. So, you know, he's got to keep his head up. We've got a long season, so he'll be back out there, you know, and we got to keep playing the way we're playing. I mean, we're playing hard, you know. We had some good situational hitting. We did some really good things. So we just got to keep going.
I know you guys have talked about wanting to be more results-driven this year as opposed to just the process. Can you walk me through, after a game like this, where your mind goes in that sort of kind of oscillation?
Hey, we played the game well. We played hard. You know, we fell behind. We came back. And then, you know, unfortunately, we couldn't finish it up. So, you know, now tomorrow, we just got to focus on trying to go 1-0 tomorrow. That's all you can do, right? You do everything right for nine innings, get two outs, and you know, things just don't go your way.
The two homers came on splitters that were both up. Did you like that he went with those pitches? And what did you think about that pitch?
I'm not ever going to question what pitches they throw. You know, just if he throws a splitter, he knows it's got to go down. They were just up. You know, like I said, location was bad.
Well, Kyle Finnegan's unraveling in the bottom of the ninth on Sunday afternoon capped a performance by the Nats bullpen that had been shaky, although had also produced three scoreless innings. Robert Garcia tossed a scoreless bottom of the sixth despite giving up two singles. Dylan Floro tossed a scoreless bottom of the seventh despite giving up a single and a walk. And Hunter Harvey tossed a scoreless bottom of the eighth despite giving up a leadoff full count double by ex-Nat Jamer Candelario, although in fairness to Harvey, this was a double that probably should have been an out. The double came on a high fly ball off the right center field wall and passed the leaping backhanded glove of right fielder Lane Thomas on a ball that Thomas could have caught. And in another example, by the way, of Thomas having issues with a fly ball near an outfield wall. Harvey's scoreless bottom of the eighth on Sunday afternoon came off what happened with him in the bottom of the eighth on Saturday. Him allowing allowing two runs on a leadoff opposite field single by Jonathan India to right center field, a two-out five-pitch walk of Jamer Candelario, and a two-out pinch, a two-run double by Nick Martini to right field on an 0-2 pitch for a 6-4 Reds lead. And yet Harvey got the win for that game. And yet another example of how ridiculous the pitcher win stat is in baseball. Now, Kyle Finnegan, to his credit, did toss a scoreless bottom of the ninth for the save on Saturday, but each of the Nats' perceived top two relievers had problems over the weekend. Hunter Harvey in the bottom of the eighth on Saturday and Kyle Finnegan in the bottom of the ninth on Sunday afternoon. The shame of the Nats losing two out of three games at the Reds is that there were a good number of positives for the Nats over the final two games of the series. Trey Lipscomb, the Nats on Saturday afternoon announced having selected the contract of Lipscomb from AAA Rochester as the corresponding roster move to placing third baseman Nick Senzel on the 10-day injured list, retroactive to March 27th with a fractured right thumb that he suffered while fielding a grounder prior to the Nats' loss at the Reds on opening day. Now, Lipscomb being called up was off the Nats last Tuesday afternoon, having announced having transferred Lipscomb to minor league camp. He was the final position player cut for the Nats' 2024 regular season opening 26-man active roster. Lipscomb is not an elite prospect, but he is the Nats' number 16 prospect per MLB Pipeline. He was their 2023 minor league defensive player of the year and was the winner of the 2023 Rawlings Minor League Gold Glove Award for third baseman. The Nats took Lipscomb in the third round of the 2022 MLB draft out of the University of Tennessee. He is a local. He went to Urbana High School in Frederick County, Maryland. Well, Trey Lipscomb over the weekend was impactful in each of his first two major league regular season games. He was an Nats starting third baseman and number nine batter for each of the final two games of the series. The 7-6 win at the Reds on Saturday, Lipscomb went 1-for-4 with a single and a stolen base and made multiple nice defensive plays. And the 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds on Sunday afternoon, Lipscomb went 2-for-3 with a solo homer, a single, and a walk. He and the Nats' one-run seventh had a tie-breaking leadoff opposite field home run to right center field on a 1-2 pitch for his first career major league regular season home run and for a 4-3 Nats lead. Great stuff from Trey Lipscomb. Davey Martinez during his post-game session with reporters on Sunday afternoon on Trey Lipscomb.
Yeah, the way he hit it, you know, ball up over the out over the zone to right center field was awesome, you know. But that, you know, I watched him all spring do that, you know, with two strikes, just shorten up his swing and stay on the baseball and try to drive the ball up the middle. He's been good, you know. I mean, the whole his defense, his base running, everything, man. He's been playing well his first two games.
All right, so Trey Lipscomb had a very nice weekend. Another key young Nats player in the rebuild, C.J. Abrams, had a very nice weekend. He was a Nats starting shortstop and number one batter for all three games in the series. A 7-6 win at the Reds on Saturday. Abrams went 1-for-2 with a triple and three walks, and he went 3-for-3 on stolen bases, and he made a very nice defensive play. In the bottom of the first, on a liner by Spencer Steer, made a diving backhanded catch on the border of the infield dirt and the outfield grass for the second out. And then in the 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds on Sunday afternoon, Abrams went 1-for-4 with a solo homer. He and the Nats' one-run third had a one-out solo homer on a bomb to right field for a 1-0 Nats lead. The homer winner projected 429 feet per Statcast and came in an 8-pitch plate appearance in which Abrams at one point was down 0-2. Awesome plate discipline off him drawing those three walks on Saturday. Abrams did not draw many walks last season, although he, as last season went on, did get better at drawing walks. But Abrams over the weekend demonstrating outstanding plate discipline. You love to see that. Another key young Nats player, Keibert Ruiz. He was the Nats starting catcher and number six batter in all three games in the series. Keibert in the 7-6 win at the Reds on Saturday, very good. 3-for-4 with a game-tying solo homer, an RBI single, another single, and a game-tying RBI hit-by-pitch. a bases-loaded hit-by-pitch. Although Keibert in that 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds on Sunday afternoon did go 0-for-5. I do want to salute Jesse Winker. Jesse Winker is what you call a placeholder player. He's keeping a seat warm for one of the Nats' top two prospects, outfielders Dylan Cruz and James Wood as they make their ways to the majors. The Nats, this past February 13th, signed Winker to a minor league contract with a non-roster invitation to Major League spring training. He had a good exhibition season, made the regular season opening Major League active roster, and has been the Nats' starting left fielder and number three batter in all three of the Nats' games so far this regular season. But Winker, over the weekend, was productive. I give him credit. The 7-6 win at the Reds on Saturday, Winker went 2-for-4 with an RBI single, another single, a walk, and an outfield assist. A Winker in the bottom of the second with a runner on first, two outs, and the game scoreless, had an outfield assist on a great throw to get Santiago Espinal out at home on a two-out full count single by Stuart Fairchild to left field. And then in the 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds on Sunday afternoon, Winker got on base four times. He went 2-for-3 with a double, a single, a walk, and a hit by pitch. The walk was impressive. Winker in the top of the fifth drew a one out 10 pitch walk despite having been down in the count at 1.12. The Nats starting pitching in losing two or three games at the Reds was not good. The 8-2 loss at the Reds last Thursday, Josiah Gray allowed 7 runs in 4 innings. The 7-6 win at the Reds on Saturday, Patrick Corbin allowed 4 runs in 4 and a third innings. He did toss 3 scoreless innings, but then was charged with 4 runs over the 4th and 5th innings. Corbin, in a Reds 1-run 4th, gave up a 2-out solo homer by the ex-Nat, Jamer Candelario, to left field to tie the game at 1. Corbin, in a Reds 3-run 5th, was charged with 3 runs. He, in the inning, gave up a 1-out 2-run opposite field home run by Luke Maley to right center field for a 3-2 Reds lead. And then in the 6-5 walk-off loss at the Reds on Sunday afternoon, Jake Irvin allowed 3 runs in 5 innings. Now, that was the best of the 3 outings by Nats starting pitchers in the series, but even this outing was not that good. Irvin gave up 7 hits, which were comprised of a triple, a double, and 5 singles. He issued 2 walks and a balk. He recorded 4 strikeouts. He threw 80 pitches, just 46 strikes versus 34 balls. Next up for the Nats is their first home series of the 2024 regular season, a 3-game series against the Pittsburgh Pirates at Nationals Park. Now, the forecasts for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday are calling for rain, but the schedule for the series is as follows. Game 1, Monday afternoon at 4:05, Mackenzie Gore will be the Nats starting pitcher. Game 2, Wednesday evening at 6:45, Trevor Williams will be the Nats starting pitcher. And Game 3, Thursday afternoon at 4:05, Josiah Gray will be the Nats starting pitcher. The Orioles began their 2024 regular season with as much optimism and as many positive vibes as the team had had going into a regular season in years, maybe ever. And that optimism and those positive vibes only grew off what happened over the team's first 2 games of the regular season. Now, Game 3 did not go so well, but the O's still won 2 of 3 games against the Los Angeles Angels at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. This past Thursday, an 11-3 win over the Angels. Saturday, a 13-4 win over the Angels in a game in which the O's scored 9 runs in the bottom of the 6th, and all of those runs were scored with no outs. And then Sunday afternoon, a 4-1 loss to the Angels. So yes, a wah-wah kind of ending to the series, but still a really good regular season opening series for the O's. As good as the offense was over the first 2 games, the biggest positive in the series to me was the Orioles starting pitching, especially considering that 2 key starting pitchers in Kyle Bradish and John Means have started this regular season on the 15-day injured list. The 11-3 win over the Angels this past Thursday, Corbin Burnes was awesome. 1 run in 6 innings with 11 strikeouts versus no walks. He gave up just 1 hit, which was a solo homer by Mike Trout. The 13-4 win over the Angels on Saturday, Grayrod was awesome. Grayson Rodriguez, he allowed 1 run in 6 innings with 9 strikeouts versus 1 walk. He gave up 4 hits, which were comprised of a solo homer and 3 singles. He issued a wild pitch. He threw a lot of strikes, 84 pitches, 57 strikes versus just 27 balls. And then the 4-1 loss to the Angels on Sunday afternoon. Look, Tyler Wells wasn't great, but he was decent. Wells allowed 4 runs, 3 earned in 6 innings. Okay, not a tremendous final line, but he allowed the 4 runs, 3 earned over the first 2 innings, then retired the final 13 batters he faced. Wells for the game gave up just 5 hits, which were made up of a 2-run homer and 4 singles, and he had 7 strikeouts versus no walks, and he threw a lot of strikes, 82 pitches, 61 strikes versus just 21 balls. O's manager, Brandon Hyde, during his post-game press conference on Sunday afternoon on Tyler Wells.
They were aggressive on him early in the game, and kind of on time with his fastball. They were aggressive on him early in the count, and then he made a couple adjustments where they started mixing pitches a little bit more, and he's got really good slider and cutter and a changeup, and just a little bit too late, but 6 great innings after the start that he had.
Yes, sir. Can/will the Orioles starting pitching hold up without Kyle Bradish and John Means for however long those guys are out? The answer from this regular season opening series was yes, but we, of course, have a ways to go. The O's did lose another pitcher to an injured list. The O's on Sunday afternoon announced having placed reliever Cionel Perez on the 15-day injured list with a right oblique strain. Perez and Mike Bauman in the top of the ninth of the 13-4 win over the Angels on Saturday combined to allow 3 runs. Perez left that game due to injury. The Orioles bullpen did have a so-so series. Orioles relievers over the 3 games combined to allow 5 runs, 4 earned in 9 innings. And then there was the Orioles offense, which was frighteningly good over the first 2 games of the series, but then went quiet in the final game of the series. The 11-3 win over the Angels this past Thursday. The O's scored 11 runs, totaled 10 hits, worked 6 walks, went 3 for 11 with runners in scoring position. The 13-4 win over the Angels on Saturday. The O's scored 13 runs, totaled 14 hits, worked 2 walks, went 6 for 10 with runners in scoring position. But then the 4-1 loss to the Angels on Sunday afternoon. The O's scored just 1 run, totaled just 3 hits, and went just 1 for 5 with runners in scoring position, though the O's did draw 5 walks. We did see this feast or famine aspect to the Orioles offense last season. At times, the offense was tremendous. At times, the offense was feeble. And we did get that in the small sample size that was this 3-game regular season opening series. Next up for the O's is a 3-game series against the Kansas City Royals at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Game 1, Monday evening at 6:35. Dean Kramer will be the Orioles starting pitcher. Game 2, Tuesday evening at 6:35. Cole Irvin will be the Orioles starting pitcher. And Game 3, Wednesday afternoon at 1:05, Corbin Burnes will be the Orioles starting pitcher. Well, our tanking and rebuilding Wizards have just 7 games left in the 2023-2024 NBA regular season. 7 more chances to make the record even worse. 7 more chances in the quest to have as good of a chance as possible for the number 1 overall pick in the 2024 NBA draft. Although the 2024 NBA draft is not viewed as a very good draft, the 2025 NBA draft is viewed as a very good draft. But anyway, 2 games for the Wizards over the weekend, 2 more losses for our Wizards over the weekend. Friday night, a 96-87 loss to the NBA worst Detroit Pistons at Capital One Arena. Yes, the Wizards on Friday night lost at home to the NBA worst Pistons, who via this win snapped an 8-game losing streak. The Wizards in that game overcame a 19-point halftime deficit, took an 83-82 lead in the fourth quarter, but then lost the rest of the game 14-4. Then Sunday evening, a 119-107 loss to the Miami Heat at Capital One Arena in a game in which the Wizards trailed for all of the second half. So the Wizards for this regular season now are 14-61, a mere half game ahead of the Pistons for the worst record in the NBA. The Pistons are 13 and 61. The Wizards do continue to be without a number of key guys. Tyus Jones now has not played in 9 consecutive games due to a back injury. Landry Shamet now has not played in 11 consecutive games due to a left calf strain. Eugene Omoruyi now has not played in 7 consecutive games due to a sprained right ankle. Additionally, remaining done for the season are Bilal Coulibaly due to a right wrist fracture and Isaiah Livers due to a right hip ailment. And Rashawn Holmes did not play in either of the 2 games over the weekend due to a left toe contusion. And Kyle Kuzma did not play in the loss to the Heat on Sunday evening due to a right heel contusion. And so we had some bad offense for our Wizards over the weekend. The loss to the Pistons on Friday night was the Wizards' worst offensive game of this regular season, in my opinion anyway. The Wizards scored just 87 points, marking the team's fewest points in a game in this regular season. The Wizards in the fourth quarter scored just 12 points. The Wizards went just 9 of 33 on threes and just 27 of 55 on twos. Two starters in Kyle Kuzma and Jordan Poole would have combined 8 of 37 from the field, just 1 of 14 on threes and just 7 of 23 on twos. Again, this was in a home game against the worst team in the NBA in the Pistons, and Kuzma and Poole still couldn't get the job done. The Wizards generated just 8 free throw attempts the entire game. The Wizards committed 19 turnovers. Kuzma and Poole each committed 5 turnovers. The Wizards' defense on Friday night was good, but the Wizards' offense on Friday night was rather bad. And the offense in the loss to the Heat on Sunday evening, while better, still was not good. The Wizards went just 11 of 38 on threes and just 16 of 21 on free throws and committed 16 turnovers, though the Wizards did score 56 points in the paint and going 28 of 46 in the paint. We did get a good weekend for Denny Avdija, who, with Bilal Coulibaly done for the season, is the Wizards player who I care about the most right now. The Wizards took Avdija with the number 9 overall pick in the 2020 NBA draft. He is a potential building block for the Wizards. He, in the loss to the Pistons on Friday night, nearly had a triple-double. Avdija, in 38 minutes, 46 seconds as a starter, went 2 of 6 on threes, 4 of 8 on twos, and 4 of 4 on free throws. He finished with 18 points, 11 rebounds, and 9 assists, though he did commit 5 turnovers. And then Avdija, in the loss to the Heat on Sunday evening, 38 minutes, 16 seconds as a starter. He went 1 of 3 on threes, 4 of 9 on twos, and 4 of 4 on free throws, finished with 15 points, 9 rebounds, and 6 assists versus 3 turnovers. But then there's Corey Kispert, who the Wizards took with the number 15 overall pick in the 2021 NBA draft. He's got to be more consistent. He, in the loss to the Pistons on Friday night, shot very well from the field. 37 minutes, 58 seconds as a starter, 5 of 7 on threes, 4 of 5 on twos. He finished with 23 points and 6 rebounds. But then Kispert, in the loss to the Heat on Sunday evening, in 40 minutes, 48 seconds as a starter, went just 1 of 7 on threes and just 2 of 4 on free throws. He did go 4 of 6 on twos, finished with 13 points, 3 assists versus 1 turnover, 2 steals, and 2 rebounds. Next up for the Wizards are back-to-back games on Tuesday night and Wednesday night. The Wizards are home to the second-best team in the Eastern Conference, the Milwaukee Bucks, Tuesday night at 7, and then are home to the Los Angeles Lakers Wednesday night at 7. And that will do it for you and me for now. Keep the feedback coming. You can hit me up on X at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi Podcast at yahoo.com. Tuesday show, episode 796. We'll have plenty for you on the Commanders. Also on Tuesday show, I'll talk Nationals and Orioles. The Nats, weather permitting, have their 2024 regular season home opener on Monday afternoon. Game 1 of a 3-game series against the Pittsburgh Pirates at Nationals Park, a 4:05 first pitch. The O's on Monday evening at 6:35 have game 1 of a 3-game series against the Kansas City Royals at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Have a great rest of your Monday, and I'll talk to you on Tuesday.
I don't even like Drake.
You don't like the Drake?
I hate the Drake.
I love the Drake.
How could you not like the Drake?
Who's the Drake?
Who's the Drake?
The Drake is good. Oh.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.